Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm talking with Anthony Randazzo. He's the Director of Economic Research for Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes this podcast. Our topic today is the mortgage interest deduction from federal taxes, which is being targeted by Republican tax reform, both in its House and Senate versions. Supporters of the interest deduction say it's a great thing that should be preserved or even expanded. It supports the American dream of owning a home, we're told, and owning a home is objectively better than renting, blah, blah, blah. Anthony's research comes to a sharply different conclusion. It's fact-based research, and we're going to talk about that today. Anthony, thanks for talking to The Reason Podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Nick.
All right. So, you know, one of the things that you hear over and over again is that the mortgage interest deduction is a middle class support program. It's technically a tax expenditure, which means that it's, you know, it's money that's given back from the government, you know, from taxes that would be otherwise collected. Before we get into why it's not what it's cracked up to be, can you quickly go through what are the main changes that the House Republican bill and the House Senate bill are offering in terms of the GOP tax reform?
Sure. And I mean, let's caveat this with, by the time that anybody hears this, these things could change because of how much the Senate kicks things around. But the Senate bill as it stands right now would put a cap on the size of the deduction that you can take by limiting it to the interest on your first $500,000 of principal. So basically, mortgages that are $500,000 or less, or up to that $500,000 cap in the principal, you can claim interest up to that amount.
Okay.
That is different from the House bill. The House bill, it doesn't have that cap, but it does say that home equity lines of credit are no longer applicable.
Okay, so because I say this as a homeowner. I know that I have a line of credit against my house, a home equity loan for, I don't know, it's like up to $10,000. And so if I max that out and then I'm paying interest on that, I can deduct that interest from my taxes similar to the mortgage interest.
That's right. Yeah, slightly different calculation. But, you know, this is the, you can think of this as the support for subcontractors that like to
sure.
do upgrades in your house.
And well, you know, and I guess even before we get into the way that the deduction plays out, this is also one of the main reasons why people are told, oh, you should buy a house. I mean, is that housing is one of these industries that has a multiplier effect throughout the economy. So that, you know, when you buy a house, unlike when, I don't know, you buy a bowl of soup or you buy a bouncing ball or you go to a Red Sox game. When you buy a house, it actually triggers all of this economic activity throughout the economy, and that it is somehow better and more important than, you know, merely, I don't know, buying and selling libertarian magazine.
Well, it just redirects where you spend your money. You know, if you're a renter, then that means that you've got disposable income to subscribe to libertarian magazine mm-hmm. or go to baseball games. And if you're a homeowner, you've got to put all that money into boring things like refrigerators and washers and dryers. And apparently, the multiplier effect matters a lot more for washers and dryers.
Right. So it's so let's talk about the mortgage interest deduction plan is often sold as a middle class support system that it, you know, what it really does is, you know, obviously billionaires and millionaires, you know, can take care of themselves. And poor people, you know, they either are not going to be they're not going to be owning their houses, or they get, you know, some kind of super luxe loan, cheap loan from the government or whatever. But it's the middle class that suffers. Why isn't the mortgage interest deduction actually why is it not a middle class support program?
Okay, so there's a couple of reasons. First is that the vast majority of tax filers don't even itemize their deductions. So to claim the mortgage interest deduction, you have to have enough itemized things in your taxes that are greater than the standard deduction. And the vast majority of tax filers, around 70%, actually just claim the standard deduction. This is that around $12,000 deduction that you see on your taxes every year. So the vast majority of people don't even itemize. And if you're itemizing, it means that you have a lot of special things. We're talking about small business owners or people who are particularly wealthy, have a lot of donations or a lot of business losses to write off.
Can I ask for $12,000 in mortgage interest, because that's part of when you say 70% of individual tax filings, they claim the standard deduction. Part of that is, there's a lot of homeowners in that category, and it's that their mortgage interest isn't $12,000 or more. I mean, do you know off the top of your head, what kind of mortgage at, a typical rate? How big is your mortgage that you're actually paying over $12,000 in interest?
That is a great question that I should crunch some numbers, and then we should record something afterwards and plug it in here, right?
Okay. I say this as somebody who, I'm a homeowner, and I own a house in Ohio in a small town. It's worth, $160,000 or $170,000, which is very low price. It's a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house. The mortgage is with taxes and everything rolled in, it's about $1,000 a month. So it's very cheap for a homeowner, but I don't even know what my mortgage, how much mortgage interest I pay every year. So it's, right, which is kind of relevant here.
It's incredibly relevant. You just put it in there. If you use a simple number, if you had a $2,000 mortgage payment, which is going to be fairly high, you're only paying $2,400 over the course of a year. In the early years of paying off a mortgage, a lot of your payments actually are interest. So, it's conceptual that for the first couple of years for a modest-sized mortgage that you might get up to something like $10,000 of your mortgage payment is actually interest, 10 or 12. But that's only going to be for the first couple of years, and that's only if you're dealing with mortgages. The actual mortgage to paying out is more than a couple of grand.
Right.
Each month.
Okay. So, the first reason why the mortgage interest deduction is overrated as a thing is that, most people don't even itemize their taxes, including a lot of homeowners. The idea that this is, somehow, helping the middle class stay in that house rather than, horrors of horrors having to rent. Because we all know, all of us who have relatives who remember the Depression, this is the worst thing in the world. It's just not actually hitting that many people. What about the people who do itemize? Do they get that do itemize? What percentage of tax returns are getting any benefit at all from the mortgage interest deduction?
So about 30% itemize, about 20% of all income tax returns claim the mortgage interest deduction. So we can boil this all down to, and it's fairly consistent. If you look at IRS data over the last 10, 15 years, it tends to be 20, 21, 22% of tax returns wind up claiming some kind of mortgage interest deduction. Large or small. So that's the pool that we're looking at. And that number, the most recent figures, that's about 35 million households getting about $70 billion in wealth transfer.
So that's $70 billion a year that the government is not taking in. And, here, I have libertarian angels and devils on my shoulders here. So on the one hand, you're saying, this is a tax expenditure. The way that it is accounted for in federal budgeting, it means the government actually kind of takes that money and then allows you to keep it. So it's a transfer. That's how it's accounted for. And one side, I can hear, the Grover Norquist of the world saying, look, that's $70 billion of your money that you get to keep. And who says it's the government's money to begin with? It shouldn't be. So there's that one, one argument. And then the other argument is that, you're getting $70 billion because you're doing something, a behavior the government approves of, buy a house rather than rent. And that's $70 billion a year, and we're like running deficits of anywhere between $300 billion a year to $1 trillion a year at times. So, yeah, what the fuck? I mean, like, why aren't we taking that money in? How do you square those?
So I think the counter to the Grover view of the world here is it's not necessarily all $70 billion that we all get to keep. It's $70 billion that 35 million households get to keep, whereas there are a couple hundred million other households that don't have access to be able to like keep their hard-earned money simply because they don't own a home. So I don't own a home. I rent. I live in the very expensive New York City.
I'm uncomfortable talking to a renter because I know that, you know, renters are more like they don't keep their apartments as clean. They are more likely to cause crime. They are, you hear this litany, this parade of horribles that renters are just really kind of garbage compared to homeowners.
I'm a little frustrated talking to a homeowner because you get to keep more of your hard-earned money, or at least have the potential to, than I do because you have access to this credit.
I will also, and I don't want to get off track here, but homeowning is a nightmare, especially unless you're in one of a very few markets where housing appreciates much faster than the rate of inflation. And of course, in those same markets, it also drops a lot quicker than the rate of economic recession. So it's, it's a two-edged sword. But homeowning is a pain in the ass, you know, in a way that you were joking about, like, oh, yeah, well, I don't have to worry about buying the refrigerator or cleaning the pipes and stuff. It's a nightmare. But I mean, basically what you're saying is that, the mortgage interest deduction is it's the result of special interest lobbying and saying that, from a libertarian perspective, ultimately, we want to pay, we want to pay taxes to pay for government services. We're not anarchists, or at least I'm not. I'm not sure about you, Anthony, but then we don't want the government to be picking winners or losers and saying like, oh, OK, well, you get preferential treatment because you buy a house. You don't get preferential treatment because you rent. I mean, like, why is the government making a value judgment that ends up changing who has to pay what taxes?
Yeah, I mean, I would rather there simply be a reduction in income tax rates that is the equivalent of reducing revenue by $70 billion than having a special deduction program that goes specifically to homeowners versus renters, and also current homeowners versus future home buyers, because this also can tend to push up the price of homes.
Right.
So there's the renters and future homeowners.
And if you're a future owner, because you don't get the mortgage interest deduction, you have less money that you can bank in order to put, to get a down payment, et cetera. So it's kind of like entitlement spending, where it's like, old people who tend to be wealthier, they not only get, Social Security regardless of need and Medicare regardless of need, but it's coming out of the pockets of relatively younger future retirees who have less money than to spend to, fund their own retirement. Quite frustrating. But what about the pragmatics of this? Does the, another major argument in favor of the mortgage interest deduction is that it makes home ownership possible by reducing the final price of a home for home buyers, assuming that we want more people to buy, to own rather than rent. Is that accurate? Does the mortgage interest deduction actually support home ownership?
So I'm going to say emphatically, no, it does not. And there are plenty of realtors and home builders and mortgage bankers, and probably even individuals who stand in opposition to that. But here's the hard data. Okay. So, So we're talking about that $70 billion and how that gets distributed. Of that amount, 82% of it goes to households with incomes over $100,000. So I'm not going to make a value judgment as to like what middle class is or not, but 82% of that $70 billion is going to people making over $100,000 a year. Which is, I think we could all just degree, if you're making over six figures, then a mortgage interest deduction is probably not going to be the thing that determines whether or not you're going to buy a home. So let's look at people making less. So depending on how we want to define sort of like middle class, somewhere between income of $30,000 to $50,000 or $30,000 to even $75,000 a year.
And that depending is, by the way, what is the median home or the median?
Median income is about $50,000, right? So median is about $50,000.
And the median household income, though, is probably more like $57,000 or can be close to $60,000, right?
If you're bundling into, so let's say $30,000 to $75,000 is our middle class bracket for the sake of argument here. The average benefit for that group, $30,000 to $75,000 a year, is about $60 a month. That's actually $62.75 a month off the mortgage. So this is to make the argument that the mortgage interest deduction supports homeownership, the argument is that there is a group of people that want to buy a home that can't afford to buy a home, but if we can get them $62.75 more a month, they will be able to afford a mortgage. Now, as an economist, I'm taught to think on the margins, and I can probably feel comfortable saying there might be one person out there, or two, maybe three, that's the kind of thing that matters. But it's absurd to contend that the difference between buying a home or not is somewhere between $50 and $75 a month off your mortgage. All that does is it increases the size of home that you can buy or the size of mortgages you can afford. It does not support home.
So it's not the decision tree branch of owning or not owning. It's really when you make the decision to own, it's how much house you own or how much debt you take on. And we've seen this in other areas where when the government offers free or reduced money through, you know, whether it's through actual grants, in higher education or healthcare, or through reduced submarket loan rates, through tax breaks, you get what is the technical term? Is it malinvestment? I mean, where you get money going in places that, absent government intervention, it wouldn't be going into supporting higher home prices or bigger debt.
Yeah, you get skewed incentives and you realign the distribution of how dollars flow in society. If you are in the construction industry, buying larger, more expensive homes probably is to your benefit. But if you are in any industry where that money might otherwise be spent instead of being on a larger home, then you've lost out. But that money gets so diffuse and those interests are so diffuse, you can't really sort of like peg any single one of them. And it's impossible for any of those diffuse interests to stand up and say, hey, we're being hurt by this. It's a lot easier for the industry, the interest that benefits to sort of stake out a claim that, hey, this is important. It's important for me. It's important for my industry that people be able to buy bigger and more expensive homes. Of course, you can't say that. So then you say it supports home ownership.
So it's the old story, which is at the, is kind of the narrative of, or the meta narrative of a lot of government actions, which is it's concentrated benefits and diffuse costs. Because we're looking not at 35 million people. We're looking at, an industry that is able to say, look, you're supporting home ownership. And that is, that's jet fuel on the economy. And all of us are paying, including, part of what your research shows is that even those of us who take the mortgage interest deduction, that's good. That's money back to us. But we're also paying for it in different ways. I'm old enough to remember very vaguely the 1986 comprehensive tax reform that was done in the second Reagan term, and it was a bipartisan deal. It was huge, and it really, substantially changed the way that we think about taxes. One of the things I can remember from that was that there was a wide range of debt of consumer debt that was tax deductible that got written out of the tax code. And so things like credit card debt, I can remember people talking, that credit card interest, which at the time could be, it was easily in the double digits because the interest rates were really high. But you could deduct that off of your taxes. That deduction was zeroed out in the 80s tax reform. What happened to the mortgage interest deduction there? Because what did it exist before that, or in what form? And then, that one made it through. What is the history of the contemporary mortgage interest deduction?
Right. Well, the mortgage interest deduction doesn't really exist on its own terms prior to the 1980s, because it's just baked into all other interest. Let's go back to 1913, which is when the whole notion of deducting interest sort of kicks off. The way the American economy is structured then is you have a lot more sole proprietors. You have a lot more individuals that are working in businesses where their own personal expenses and business expenses are all bundled together. It's almost impossible to separate them out. And so it's just the notion is we're just going to allow for all interest to be deducted. Now jump back to the time we're talking about. So you jump 70 years forward. The idea of credit card interest being deducted was never part of the intent of that portion of the tax code. And so it's fairly easy to make an argument that this is
credit cards didn't exist in the teens. They didn't really become a popular or widespread phenomenon really until the 1970s. So that's considered bad debt, right? Because that's just consumer debt. That means you're going out and buying a steak dinner. And a steak dinner, there's no economic overflow effect from that, right? And that doesn't multiply economic activity the same way a house does, right?
Well, what we decided as a society is that debt that manifests as investment is good debt, and debt that keeps us from having to defer gratification is bad debt. And then that might be the right way to think about things. I tend to sort of scoff at individuals who say that all student loans are bad, because in some instances, a student loan very well can be an investment in one's own future, just like investing in a company. It just depends on the kind of student loan, the amount and what you get for it. $100,000 for a communications degree of debt is a lot different than, say, $50,000 in debt for a legal degree. So the idea that debt is all bad, I certainly dismiss that idea. But the idea that debt that supports investment, and then housing is an investment, therefore debt associated with housing is good, has at its core fundamental flaw, which is that housing is a good investment. It's this cultural notion, this touchdown.
You're wrong, Anthony Randazzo, renter in New York, because this is my parents who were, born in the 20s, raised in the Depression. They bought a house. They owned one house their entire life. They bought it in 1967 in suburban New Jersey, and it cost $18,000. And 40 years later, they sold it for $250,000. What a great investment. You're wrong. Explain to me, and that is the story. I mean, I was told by my parents, you got to buy a house. It's the one investment that everybody can own. And, they had a VA mortgage because my father was a veteran. You're wrong. Like what is wrong about that very basic, very widespread American gospel of wealth that, owning a house is a goddamn great investment, and woe to those who decide to rent rather than own.
So the specific example, let me get the numbers right, is $18,000 investment over 40 years yields a return of $250,000.
Right.
Roughly. Right. More or less. So the argument is that there's no other way to have grown $18,000 over 40 years I'm fairly comfortable with saying that $18,000 invested in the S&P around those rough times. I didn't catch the year that, you know, sold at 250, but over 40 years, the growth in S&P, Dow, markets in general, exponential growth, and real returns, real market returns, inflation adjusted returns of 4 to 6% or more would have yielded more out of that, would have yielded much more of that $18,000, right? So then the counter, though, is but you have to pay rent along the way, right? So you have costs. So part of the argument of this as an investment is, I'm investing, I bought this home, and now I've reduced an expense. So sure, for some people in certain markets where rent is high and where home values grow quickly, owning a home can be a good investment. But in the aggregate, if you look at the growth in housing prices in the United States over the past 100 years, the value of homes has not grown much more than at the rate of inflation. It has grown at about 3% a year over the last 100 years, which is just above roughly the rate of inflation over that time frame. Which is not to say that it's bad to own a home necessarily. It's not to say that for every single individual it always makes sense to rent, because that's obviously not the case. But it is to say that this whole idea that investing in a home is the single greatest way that you can use your resources is a massive overstatement. And that the idea that we should be supporting that kind of investment by supporting debt to the point at which in 1986, we look at the tax code and we say, credit card debt is bad, but investing in your home, that's good. So we're going to support that kind of debt because this is a good investment, supports the growth of the American dream, and homeownership is one of the things. That's just a false notion, that there's no data to back it up.
So it's a confluence of two things. One, when we're talking about concentrated benefits and diffuse costs, you have the home building industry and the home selling industry, which are massive because a lot of people are employed in construction and subcontracting and all that. There's the whole realtor thing. There's even the subsidiary, public schools have an interest in keeping house values up, because the more that a house costs, the more you pay in taxes, the more that the local school has. You have all of that. Plus you have homeowners who are, do we know on average, or is there a figure that we can say that the home interest mortgage deduction, raises house prices? Is it like 2%? Is it 5%? I mean, is there a way to calculate that? But, there's people who are locked in. They bought something at an inflated price, and the best way to maintain that is to keep the status quo, right? I mean, so is it just the confluence of these political constituencies
there's a pretty deep literature of economists trying to get at how the mortgage interest deduction affects home prices. And the only conclusion from that fairly deep literature is that it does increase prices, but there's no consensus as to exactly how much. Most of the estimates tend to land around it increases prices a couple of percentage points. But the reason why the literature doesn't have a strong conclusion is simply because of the old adage that all housing is local. And there's so many other factors that influence housing prices that the mortgage interest deduction winds up being caught up in a lot of noise. And when I first began studying this part of the tax code several years ago, that was part of my sort of research interest was, how is this actually skewing the marketplace for homes? You come across, well, no one really knows exactly how much, but that kind of makes sense in that there's just because the benefits are so small relative to the size of household earnings. There really are not that many people that are going into buying a home thinking about the mortgage interest deduction. And so it doesn't have a very heavy influence on that decision-making process. Where it probably influences people the most is in the purchase of a second home, when transitioning from, say, the first home that one purchases, selling that home and moving somewhere else, or buying a larger home. Once you have got your feet sort of firmly planted on what it means to be a homeowner and understanding your own finances, you might be able to determine, the mortgage interest deduction, for me, I could probably get a home with a mortgage of, $60, $70 more a month. That means I can buy that home at that higher price. And so you get a gentle upward push on home prices.
So two things from what you were just talking about. First is, let's talk about the, I guess this Republican plan in a way, and, this is, at least I guess the Senate version, is kind of a bold plan, because not only does it cap the amount that is allowable, the amount of principal against which interest is deductible, that's a pretty big deal, especially because $500,000. I mean, what is the median house price in America is, not for a new house, but an existing house is somewhere under, like around $200,000 or a little bit less, I think. That's saying something, because everybody, if you live in New York, if you live in Washington, Boston, I guess Miami, LA, San Francisco, Arizona, Phoenix, every house costs, $500,000 will get you a shed in the back of a manor or something like that. But, realistically, this is really reducing, the amount that you can, that you can expense. So that's kind of bold. And also, do both bills get rid of the deduction for second homes, which has always struck me as amazing? The idea that you could, you can buy, a home and a spare and deduct a mortgage on both. And there, I guess it's not about pushing for, more home ownership, because you can only have a second house, you can only deduct the second home loan if you already have one. So you're already owning a house. But there, it's probably was sold more on the grounds that, this really helps the economy to, keep buying or building second homes.
Yeah, that's just a logical extension of the idea that debt related to owning a home is debt like investing in a business. Therefore, whether it's a first or a second home, that's something that a society we want to support. And that's just a pure grab by special interest.
Right.
In Washington.
It's kind of amazing car loans, car debt didn't survive past tax bills, because you always hear what's good for General Motors is good for the USA. It's amazing that the auto industry was not able to redefine car payments as and car loans as good debt. But what is the likelihood
the auto industry lost that when the adage that your car loses half of its value the minute you drive off the lot landed in everyone's minds, and you can't really treat it like an investment.
I can remember friends of mine, and I guess in high school and right out of college, who bought cars, and that one of the salesman talking points, and I guess it's still the case, where they say that a car is an investment. And it's like, I remember my older brother saying, it's the shittiest investment in the world because it depreciates immediately. I mean, the minute you literally, you leave the parking lot of the, but what do you think politically, how viable? I mean, there are a lot of pretty gutsy moves in some of these bills, for instance, also getting rid of the deduction for state and local taxes. From the federal bill, which is another mainstay. There's some gutsy positions being staked out here. Do you think that the caps and reductions on the mortgage interest deduction are actually going to see the light of day in the final legislation or not?
I think that the politics of the House and the Senate are reflected in these. There's more realtors in the House. It's actually something that I've personally come across as sort of a source of frustration in working on housing policy. in Washington, that there's more of a hold on the house from mortgage bankers and realtors. And that, I think, is reflected in the fact that there's no cap on the mortgage exception in the House bill. I think that the Senate bill's cap at $500,000 is simply trying to find revenue somewhere. I don't think that it's a principled piece of the Senate bill at all. You know, notionally, this whole bill started with the idea of let's lower rates and reduce, simplify the code, reduce deductions. And that lowering it to $500,000, it's such a high amount that I can only interpret it as just trying to look for a little bit of money somewhere to pay for at least a piece of it so they could do something somewhere else. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that cap ultimately disappear.
Right, because this is not a tax bill that is about raising revenue, really. And the GOP, both under the George W. Bush years as well as now, has really shown no interest in reducing spending, which is another way to minimize national debt and the drag that has on the overall economy. So, how do you feel about the tax reform bill? I mean, you would agree, I suspect, that the tax code is immensely complicated. And I take it, based on your kind of attitude towards the mortgage interest deduction, that tax expenditures are kind of a problem. Carve outs for special interest or preferential buying habits or certain industries. I mean, like, why? I mean, I understand the legislative history and kind of the cultural aspect of giving, not taxing medical benefits as compensation. I understand where that comes from, but I assume you're against that kind of thing, as well as the deduction for state and local taxes, that these are all ways in which the federal government kind of picks winners or losers or pays off political constituencies.
Yeah, that's right, Nick. With respect to the mortgage interest deduction, if there's a policy goal that the legislature has decided it wants to support, and that goal is more home ownership for the middle class, then appropriate $70 billion and distribute it in a program like the Community Block Grant Development Program or something like that. Now, I don't actually want that to be the case. I've even written a paper on why community block grants are absolutely horrific, and that kind of appropriation should go away. So I'm not supporting that kind of a program, but I think it would be better policy, and it would be less skewed if it was actually structured as an appropriation in the spending plan, as opposed to a deduction that makes it very difficult for its policy aims to actually be accomplished. And that same sentiment, I think I reflect back on much of this tax reform debate. The bills that are being put together, or this bill that will come out of the conference, is less tax reform, and it's more the Republican leadership trying to get done a handful of policy goals it's been trying for a while, and packaging it all up under the banner of tax reform. There's a lot of great things in this. Lowering rates is great, but if that drives up the debt and it winds up increasing costs in the long run, it has negative effects on the economy for the amount of debt that we take on, then in the long run outcome of a bill like this is negative, then we haven't actually accomplished much.
Can I ask, Anthony, how old are you?
I am 32.
Okay, so you are you're a millennial. You're kind of in the thick of the millennial category.
Just barely.
Okay.
Yeah.
But is here, one of the things that we try to do at Reason is, we break news and we do analysis for people who are self-consciously or self-identified as libertarian. And we're the news source and the analysis source for the libertarian movement, broadly defined. We talk to colleagues in the media. We're kind of peers with people, and we try to put stories out there or ideas out there that they'll find interesting. We try to influence policymakers, politicians, business leaders, all of that kind of stuff. But one of the other things we do is we try to build the next generation of libertarians, particularly millennials. And it's like, you know, I mean, they're the group of the moment, and they're a massive generational cohort. Do you think who are getting a shit deal? I mean, in many, many ways. I mean, you know, it's just like, you know, low economic growth, you know, the big bulge in the entitlement spending, you know, public pensions everywhere, which, I mean, it just sucks money out of a vital economy to pay off stranded costs that, you know, people like you. And actually, to be honest, I'm a late baby boomer. I didn't incur these costs. I mean, we're just paying for them. But do you think millennials are ready, or what is the best way to kind of sell the idea of what you were talking about? Like, if, you know, we should have taxes that are flat and fair, or maybe if not flat, but are fair and open and transparent. And then we should have transfer programs that are also, you know, understandable, motivated by shared social consensus, and are visible. You know, is that something like, are millennials, you know, because you're coming of age really at the end of the post-war consensus of using the tax code to accomplish a lot of social goals as well as political goals and supposedly economic goals, and it's over. I mean, like, we just can't have a Swiss cheese tax code and expect to spend the revenue or expect to raise the revenue that to pay for government. Are millennials, I guess what I'm asking, are they open to this idea of a kind of transparency in government spending and government taxing? Because that seems to be, transparency is a big part of where the economy is now. You know, when you Uber, you know, the driver knows you, you know the driver. Everybody knows what the payment system is. Even something like Bitcoin, you know, a cryptocurrency, the one thing that's amazing about Bitcoin and blockchain technology, you know, which is kind of the thing of the moment, is that it's completely transparent. Everybody in the system knows when a deal has been made and the account is settled almost simultaneously with it being transacted. You know, is this the type of tax reform and the type of government provision of services that we need to be moving towards?
I think for older millennials, there's the transparency message speaks a lot stronger than probably the younger end, you know, the less motivated group. There is a sizable portion of, say, conservative millennials who rejected the Republican Party over everything from the way that they have handled embracing Trump and Roy Moore to sort of like last vestiges of the failures of the Bush administration, sort of like global wars. And for that group of, say, conservative millennials and maybe an overlap of more progressive leaning millennials, sort of transparency in programs is almost, it's certainly a message that speaks through. Such transparency really it's not going to work with packages that that go through Congress that are effectively a set of horse trades. You know, the way that this bill should be structured is, okay, if you want to leave in place something like the mortgage interest reductions benefits, kill the whole thing and appropriate a $50 billion pot of money that's going to go towards helping people pay their mortgage payments. Now, as a libertarian, I abhor all sorts of social spending programs like that, but I would in a heartbeat support a piece of legislation that did a direct trade-off like that. That basically said, we're going to end this tax deduction and we're going to replace it with an equivalent spending program. And I would support something like that because I do think that pushing it into the light of day makes it easier for us to debate about it and to talk about it.
Well, I hope you're right. And I think, you know, maybe, you know, this is part of the problem. You know, libertarians are always accused of being, you know, crazy dreamers and utopians and all of that. And it may be that the first step to a better accounting government is, you know, pushing the government benefits and transfer programs into the light of day, where they're actually kind of visible transfer payments, because that would make it easier to call them out or to even just understand what's being transferred and, you know, do a cost benefit analysis of the program.
Debate their effectiveness.
Yeah, so it becomes, you know, I mean, this is for me one of the oddest things about the last, you know, year and a half or so is that again and again, it seems to me, you know, libertarians who are used to being, you know, you're way over there on the, you know, on the horizon of the political spectrum on a shoe shine and a smile and you're in crazy land. It's like libertarians seem to be the most pragmatic people in terms of let's chisel down certain types of criminal justice overreach. Let's chisel down spending and debt, and you know, and it's all very pragmatic. And so maybe in that will be a different kind of dialogue. Anthony, what is it going to take you what am I going to have to do to put you in a $700,000, you know, 1.5-bedroom house in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, today?
If you could pick up the phone and contact the CFO of the nonprofit that I work for to, you know, bump up my salary by about 3 times, I'm all over it.
I am afraid that we're out of time. And, I call our CFO on an almost hourly basis and I go right to voicemail. So I'm afraid I can't help you there. I wish that I could, but I do want to thank you for speaking to the Reason Podcast. We've been talking with Anthony Randazzo. He's the Director of Economic Research at the Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes the Reason Podcast, which you've been listening to. I'm Nick Gillespie for that. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.